This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and I'm on remote. And Miles David Moore is here with us. He has a new book, and we're going to hear new poems. So, Miles, read us a poem from this new book, Man on Terrace with Wine.
This poem is called An Oldie. That song you used to love begins to play on FM radio. The plaintive fiddle lilts in your ears in that cathartic way it always did. It stinks then, how the middle devolves into a synthesizer slog with lyrics of a baby babbling kind. It kills you what a monumental dog this song is, but you never used to mind. The tune, the violin still cancels all your fine discernment and unerring taste. Marked as a sentimental fool, you crawl toward your exacting mind, a heart debased by all the tawdry dives it used to haunt. How we betray ourselves by what we want.
Miles David Moore, he is the author of this new book and also two other books, The Bears of Paris and Roller Coaster, both by WordWorks. What is this book about? It looks like it's a little bit about drinking.
Yes, well, in the pandemic, we all seek our different solaces. But actually, this poem is about, this book is about, how can I put it? It's about a little bit of everything. It's about, in some ways, the constant sorrow of being an outsider. But it's also about, it concerns history, it concerns family, the consolations of family. I mean, I think there's a little bit of everything in this book.
Okay, let's hear another poem.
Okay, this is the title poem. This poem is about drinking. Well, it is and it isn't about drinking. This is called Man on Terrace with Wine, recalling a line from Hermann Hesse. It's about like being at a Napa County winery and enjoying both the luxury of the wine and of the beautiful surroundings, and remembering a particularly beloved line from Hesse, the tief und tausendmal zu leben, which is literally is to live deeply in a thousandfold. I changed the line slightly for meter and also for my own purposes. Okay, Man on Terrace with Wine, recalling a line from Hermann Hesse. What happiness to dream when drinking wine, you notice beauty that you never see when sober and at work. Late summer vines glisten with purple fruit. Serenity drifts through the willows, buoys the scent and sight of lavender and baked earth. Tenderness wafts from the hills and permeates the light. You get it by the bottle or the glass. You can't prolong this feeling, yet you must. If only life itself could be your wine, you feel not dulled but heightened. Even dust waltzing in sunlit moats seems rich and fine, and you feel you are better than yourself. The mountains are your friends, the grass your home. Why must this soaring pleasure be so brief that sooner than you've reached your car, it's gone? Birds hop on empty tables, pecking crumbs and tipping beaks into abandoned dregs. Vineyards and flagstones steep in Napa sun, a benediction bright and plain. You beg to live completely and a thousandfold. Where are the vineyards when the way is rough? If deep inside you, there's a place to hold a drop of stillness, will it be enough?
Miles, how long did it take you to put together this book? How long was it in the making? And what did it take to put these poems together? Were they accumulated over time or what?
Well, definitely accumulated over time. I mean, this represents probably the last 25 years of my poetic work. The volume has changed. I changed it over time. I was trying to sell it over 10 years. It went through several different permutations. it was just a process of removing poems I thought were weaker and adding those I thought were stronger. And apparently the last version was the charm, because that's the version that Kelsey Books accepted.
That is hard to get accepted, isn't it?
Very, very.
Tell us about how is the difference between being a poet and being a critic. You are, for years, a film critic for Scene 4 magazine, and have you're known for your analytic ability and your critical eye. What is there about being a poet and the power of observation which is like that?
Well, I think it's all a matter of trying to develop your abilities to interpret what you see and what you experience. I mean, I don't think, for me at least, there's that much difference between my aesthetic response to a movie and my aesthetic response to, like, say, a tree, a piece of political news, a painting. It's just a matter of responding. It's just a matter of responding to what you see and trying to respond intelligently and also in a way that other people can appreciate. I mean, you have to think of an audience, but you can't think too hard about an audience.
You were a reporter for Crane Communications for years.
That is correct. Two business newspapers that covered the tire and rubber industries.
So let's hear another poem.
Okay. This poem, this one is a brief rhymed and metered poem called A Vandalized Churchyard. The headstones that withstood a thousand storms and snows slant broken in the mud like fallen dominoes. And that's the way it goes. Why should we make a fuss about some shattered stone? To be anonymous, unheeded, and alone is the one truth we've known. So do the dead deserve the dignity of name? Time throws all life a curve. It's just a children's game, from age to age the same. Children must have play before they go to bed. They run an ancient way where those now ashes led to unname all the dead.
Miles, what do you think about what your work has said all these years? You've been writing for, what, 30 years more? 40?
It's my first, the first serious poem that I will admit to, I wrote in 1986, so it's been 35 years. Mm-hmm. I think it's just a matter of trying to articulate what I see in the world around me and how I feel about it. It's I've always felt like a bit of an outsider, and I think my poetry expresses that, but I think it also expresses gratitude to friends and family, gratitude for the beauty of the natural world, gratitude for kindness.
And do you see that you've changed over the years when you look at your canon of works?
Yes. It's interesting. I used to write a lot more light verse than I started out with light verse. I idolized Ogden Nash when I was a kid. And, part of it is that light verse is not respected. I think it used to be a lot more respected, say, like around in the 40s and 50s than it is now.
Because it had meaning.
Yeah. Well,
it had always did have a serious undertone to it. It was never mm-hmm. to be dismissed. But let's hear some more Miles David Moore.
And okay.
The title of the book is what?
Man on Terrace with Wine. And is from Kelsey Books, published, the official publication date was October 30th, 2020. This poem contains a lot of prose poems, which is something I've only started in the last few years to write. But I'll read you the shortest one. This is called Doe at a Street Corner. And this is partly something I observed, but also partly my reaction to the pandemic. She waits on the sidewalk as if for a bus. She stands on delicate legs, deciding when to spring. She sniffs the suburban air for predators, those with engines and wheels instead of fangs or guns. She looks both ways. Natural selection. She is not one of those who will die a martyr to the freedom of crossing a road when she pleases, and her fawns will learn this wisdom from her. Her enemies are in hiding, but she has no place to hide. Her enemies have folded into themselves like flowers without sun. They are sparse on the street. They go nowhere. The reasons for them to go anywhere are negated. She has never told where she is going, nor have any of her kind. But now she has fewer places to go, which is why she is here. It is certain she cannot stay. Her ears twitch. The sound of traffic is a faraway drone. Looking again, she trots away on the correct side of the road. From a power line comes the call of a mourning dove.
Oh, Miles, you know, I read that without the title, and it was really very touching. It was almost a woman in distress. If you took out the words, ears twitching and trotting, that is I was honestly fooling around reading it. It is a powerful poem about, I felt, a female escaping. Of course, I knew that it was a doe, but the prose is so compelling. A prose poem is a certain thing. It can't be prose, and it isn't vertical, but it has to have a lyrical spring to the line. So how do you think you achieve that? I think I know how. How do you think you do?
Well, I think it's just a matter of relying on my ear. Being a journalist for 40 years, I mean, like, I know what it's like to just churn out stuff about Goodyear acquires Cooper, or pandemic closes factories, or whatever. But I think you have to have the practice of writing verse, both free verse and rhyming verse, rhymed and metered, to develop your ear enough to write a prose poem. You have to rely on your own sense of the musical cadence. And that's what I do.
Absolutely, because I looked at your consonants and your vowels, and they are the things that kept that thing rolling like a river. And that is very innate. You cannot consciously do that. That comes from years of writing and listening, because it is the repetition of those vowels and consonants that make for the meter inside the line. So that's really interesting to me. So let's move on and hear more.
Okay, well, I have been writing. Another way in which my work has changed is that I've written more about family in recent years. And this is a poem dedicated to my mother. This is called The Good Fight. She was an Army nurse during World War II, and this relates to her experiences. The English Channel surged below you, its waves licking American bones. It was D-Day plus 50, Utah Beach, and all 5'3" of you with 1,000 other nurses, helmeted, full field packed, clambered down the rope ladder swaying against the ship. The transports were like children's toys bobbing below. "Don't look down, don't slip," your commanders told you. "Your pack will drag you straight to the bottom." The Norman Fields boomed in the distance as the waves moaned their hunger. 60 summers distance from France, the explosion was in your brain. You take lessons on how to lace a shoe, how to walk with a cane. Your voice, musical as always, lilts over the nursing center's phone. "Honey, I'm going home today. Could you please call my mom and dad and tell them to come get me?" Mother, you climb a ladder now. The sky is hazy above you, a fog of dreams and memories. The decades are your backpack now. Please don't look down. Please don't slip. You fight the good fight, now as then.
I always say preserving the beloved is one of the tenets of poetry, and one of the important ones. And I remember talking to you right after your father had died, and you had a hard time writing then, and you had almost stopped writing. And then you found the secret that writing to preserve them was a very good way to continue.
Yeah, I mean, I have generally a hard time writing about my family because, you know, I sort of feel sometimes that I've always sort of felt like you sort of like betray the people you write about simply because you're not them and you can't really understand everything about them. But that changes when you write about how much you love them and how much you appreciate what they've done. I mean, both of my parents made huge sacrifices for us. I mean, enormous sacrifices for their country. My father served in Okinawa, my mother was in Europe, sacrifices for their children. I mean, they taught us honor, they taught us love, they taught us a work ethic. I mean, they were just magnificent. I feel the same way about my sisters and about the rest of my family. As a matter of fact, the next poem I have to read is about family and, you know, sort of the how family changes over time, but still stays the same in that they're wonderful. And this is called Italian American. This is dedicated to my grandniece, Sophia, and my grandnephew, Mario. It was October in Montegofoni. Steel-jawed crushers wolfed Chianti grapes in joyous cartfuls and pomegranates insinuated purple light from dooryards. I stood outside the castle, waiting with the others for the autobus to take us to Florence or Lucca or San Gimignano, when another bus, the color of sorbetto di limone, pulled into view. Small children, taking no notice of the queued-up Americans, tumbled out of the bus, clutching soccer balls and Hello Kitty or Donald Duck lunchboxes, laughing in a language I did not know. But I thought of another bambina just born an ocean and a continent away, her mother, my niece, the same northern mixture of Irish, English, German, Dutch as me, her father one generation removed from Sicily and Abruzzo. And now I think of due bambini, sister and brother, growing up in a place where crushers wolf Cabernet and Zinfandel grapes from Mondavi, Parducci, Sebastiani. The first time they went to Italy, they wanted to travel by balloon. The second time, Pope Francis blessed them at Easter Mass. They're renowned from Pescara to Santa Rosa, these mighty swimmers and marathon readers, heroes of Golden State soccer fields, fans of Team Italia, growers of pomegranates.
Beautiful. That is beautiful. I think I was with you once in Montegofoni.
You were with me many, many times at Montegofoni. I count those as among the happiest times of my life. They were just magnificent.
I agree. And we were with WordWorks Retreat, and I think almost 10 times, 10 years maybe.
Almost. Yeah, I went four times. I went four times over the years, and what a wonderful group of people, dear Hillary Tom and Karen Allen Neer, and all sorts of delightful people who were my fellow students. And thank you for being such a wonderful teacher.
Miles, you know, thinking back on those times, I realized that you have been a contributor to WordWorks on the board and have been doing so many things. You say you're an outsider, but you know, you have brought so much to bring people inside, a welcoming home. We have to mention IOTA. The reading series you had for 8 years?
23. 1994 to 2017. I mean, I think, you know, we ran laps around a lot of different reading series during that time, just by length. But yeah, I mean, I was very proud of what I accomplished with IOTA. And also thanks to Steve Negri and Jane Negri Inge, who owned IOTA and who allowed the crazy poets to assemble the second Sunday of every month. But I felt good bringing people in. I guess, you know, a lot of people would think just by my connections I'm an insider, but you know, there's always a certain amount of loneliness inside me.
Well, you have created family wherever you've gone, Miles, and it's reflected in this book. We want to hear more from this book.
Okay, well, my next poem after this, this is, again, I like to fool around with light verse. This is probably the best example of light verse I've written in a long time. It's also one of my few villanelles. It was inspired by a quote from Dorothy Parker, which is, revising poetry is like killing your babies. And this is called Infanticide. You hone the point and pray it's for the best. The cradle shudders from a feral cry. You raise the pen above your baby's chest. Let's face it now, you never have been blessed with children born as right as apple pie. You hone the point and pray. It's for the best, this little operation. You have messed before with babies ugly, bent, awry. You raise the pen above your baby's chest, its flared proboscis and its armpit nest, its fangs, five ears, and one magenta eye. You hone the point and pray it's for the best, you makeshift Dr. Frankenstein, confess creator of monstrosities. On high, you raise the pen. Above your heaving chest, your brain pans giddy from this final test, whether this child and you will live or die. You hone the point and pray it's for the best. You raise the pen above your baby's chest.
What is a villanelle?
Well, it is a 19-line poem, three triplets and a final quatrain, and you repeat the first and third lines from the first stanza throughout the poem, and the final two lines of the poem are those two repeated lines.
Is it fun?
It can be. It can be hellishly difficult and very frustrating. But with any poem, when it starts coming right, it becomes fun. It's getting it to the point when it starts coming right. That's the difficulty.
What other forms do you write in?
My two forms are sonnet and villanelle. I admire my friends who write pantoums and sestinas. I have never been able to wrap my mind around those forms. But sonnets and villanelles have an extreme fondness for rhyme and meter. Sometimes I neologize, but quite often just rhyming quatrains, rhyming couplets, rhyme royal. I like to experiment. I also try to keep my hand in free verse, and of course with prose poems, which for some reason my thoughts tend to form themselves more in a prose poem than in any other verse form. I have no idea why.
Miles, what does poetry mean to you? Why bother?
Well, I think the best way to put it, and I think many other poets have said this, is that you write poetry because you can't not write poetry. I mean, like, I remember when I was 12 years old and my parents had this old Lewis Untermeyer anthology called The Book of Living Verse, that it started with the old Scottish and English anonymous ballads. And it went through, like, it was published in 1945. The last born poet in it was Stephen Spender. But in the meantime, it had Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Wordsworth, Blake, Burns, Shelley, Keats, Poe, Whitman, Frost, Eliot, Sandburg, and the St. Vincent Millay, all the way through, just, you know, sort of a short course in English and American verse. And I just thought, man, wouldn't it be wonderful to have your name next to them?
Let's hear some poems that you just had to write.
Okay, well, this one, again, I mean, I know this is going to make me sound like the biggest alcoholic in the world, like a combination of Charles Bukowski and W.C. Fields, but this is the last poem in the book. And this one, it's less about drinking than it comes from a line of dialogue from one of my favorite movies, Moonstruck, which is, as bright and full of promise as moonlight in a martini. And the title of this is Drink Up. Heaven is yours inside a tall stemmed glass, an Eiffel Tower inverted on its tail. A million opportunities may pass. This is the one to grab. This holy grail, this glass of moonlight shining in the dark, bright as a Bombay sapphire. Like the eyes of newfound lovers, its prismatic spark halos the room as if to canonize the spirit and tonsured olive. Never mind that maybe you have had this drink before. You threw up, saw pink hippos, staggered blind. The angry barkeep bounced you out the door. Never let on you really wanted beer. This is your chance. Drink up while it's still here.
And another.
Okay, I'll do another sonnet. This is part of my being a film critic. This is called Watching Godzilla in 3D. This is your painless dose of shock and awe. A mile of scaled and sinewed CGI arising from a pixel sea. Each claw and fang engulfs the conflagrating sky. Tokyo, Las Vegas, San Francisco crumble in tune to Dolby's all-surrounding roar as you applaud the glass and stone that tumble down from the screen and vanish toward the floor. You're CGI yourself. On cue, you smile with all the film's insipid hireling crowd at this Tyrannosaurus crocodile, whose gaze you're primed to say is brave and proud, that stomps back to its ocean, having killed a world you didn't make and can't rebuild.
Miles David Moore with his new book. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is brought to you by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production, MET Studios, Mike Turpin. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding was provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family and Avi Day Shoshani with support from the Sinipet Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our engineer is Mike Turpin.